The following is an interview with Orville Howerton by Bertine Howerton for the Kentucky Oral History Commission. The interview was conducted at his home on White Oak Road on September the 8th, 1978.
As I begin this interview, I'm going back into the recesses of my mind. I'll be 64 rather, my birthday this coming next July. I'm going back about 60 years, and being born of pioneer stock, the early settlers that came into on the Howerton side in Jamestown, the best our people have studied genealogy, were early settlers. And on my mother's side, Jamestown, Virginia. On my mother's side, the family name was Har. Well, they pronounced it Hare, but later they adopted it to Har. And my first memories, it was like coming into maybe a man on exploration of a new world. Suddenly I woke up to the fact that there was things all around me, and I was very inquisitive. I asked thousands of questions. And my first memory began that my father was a school teacher. He was a son. I believe he was next, about the fourth son down of six children, and he was the only one interested in education, and they were all would rather go in the fields and work, and Perry, my father, the late Perry Howerton, would go to school. And when he graduated from grade school, he came down to Grayson, Kentucky, which he was raised in Elk County, and started a school, a normal school, teacher's college. He got his teacher's degree to teach at school.
Where was this at?
In Grayson, Kentucky. He taught, I think, in Ellett County, and then he came down in Greenup County. In those days, my mother was out of a family that was strong on education. Her grandfather was a surveyor and a school teacher, and her mother was quite an educated woman. They came down from Pennsylvania, and their names were Major. And when my father was teaching school, I guess Mom went to school for two or three years in the eighth grade, because there wasn't any high schools, so they just wanted to keep on learning. And they claimed they learned more every day. And that was...
Where did she go to school?
She went down to what they call Flat Hollow. And my father was teacher at Flat Hollow. That's where he met my mother. And they were married. And since he had served a term in the Navy, he had saved his money and bought a place on Flat Hollow where his parents was. That's where they started housekeeping.
What was your father in the Navy?
He was a pharmacist, right? He was a non-commissioned officer, and he had studied pre-med, and he knew quite a bit about medicine. Fact is, I think he could almost pass for a country doctor in his day, because he was with the hospital corps in Colorado for years before he was discharged. When he came back to Kentucky, as I said, he started teaching school. Well, I believe that they were married in July the 14th, 1914, and I was born July the 9th, 1915. And I grew up, and I was born on Flat Hollow. It's only about three miles from Portsmouth High. And as my first memory was that the world began to open up to me, but my grandfather had a grocery store. He was a merchant.
Which grandfather was it?
John Howerton. And my first sweet memories was coming down to Grandpa's store, buying soda pop. He had sawdust in days, no ice box, and he kept his ice in his sawdust, and he cooled his pop in a wash tub, I believe, or a box or something, sawdust box. And to me, that was quite a day to come off. We had a farm back on the hill, to come down and buy things like that, as kids do, Granddad's store. And we would make this pop last for about a mile. We just drank a little at a time. It was so good.
And you and your brother?
Me and my brother. He was 2 years younger than me, Ellis. Well, when I was six, I started going to school to my dad. He taught on plasma. And in the meantime, World War II had ended in 1918, and this was along in 1921, me being born 15, like me, 1921. I went my first year to school to him, and I recall that I went to school 1 year longer than, about 3 months longer, because there was some mean boys on the head of White Oak, that was a hollow over from Flat Island, and they'd run the lady teacher off. And the dad was elected to finish the school, because of Kentucky law, you had to go to school, I think, about 6 months that year, any year. So I had to go to school longer that year, and he drove a Model T Ford truck, and he finished that school up, and that year I had to go to school longer than the kids that went to Flat Island, because he wanted me to go on to school. He finished that school up, and the following year, the boom started, the post-war boom after World War I, and he went over to Fullerton, a little river city town, just south of Portsmouth, Iowa, and opened up a general store. And as my memories of the early Fullerton, the automobiles were just coming into being then. They were mostly horses. I remember the teams, the big wagons that haul sand and gravel, the big draft horses. They really, I never saw anything like that as a kid growing up. Most all our horses were small, maybe mules or maybe the 800, 900. But these horses were in the 1,600 pound class, and I never will forget. As a kid, 6-year-old, 7-year-old kid, I'd follow those horses almost down to the ferry boat.
Where was this ferry boat?
The ferry boat was located at the end of South Shore Drive, known as the Old Davis Landing. It was opposite a Union Street in Portsmouth, Ohio. Now, that was operated by the Davis family. Was a handed down. It was for many years, I understand. I guess it'd probably been 75 years, because they'd been river people up the river before they came to Fullerton. Anyway, those days, they were a city of Portsmouth was a thriving city with the post-war boom. They boasted numerous industries, which are not there now. And you could just quit a job today and go to work tomorrow. And the reason I learned about all this, I could hear people talking about work at the brickyard, and they go to the mill tomorrow, and they go work the NW. They call the NW, that was Norfolk and Western. I never will forget the lingo they used. My dad had this general store, and now that was in about 1921. He first started the store in another empty building that was formerly the old Doc Mehta's drugstore. And he stayed up there, but it was off the beaten path, so he moved down to the street that was the mostly frequently traveled going to the, I'd be going down to the ferry boat. And we could tell when the ferry had landed, because the traffic would be about 15 or 20 cars and horses all come by the rush. And there wasn't any paved streets. The dust was there. And he stayed in business there until about 1928.
What street was this located?
That was, I believe, on Harrison Street in Fullerton, Kentucky. And seems as though he developed a heart condition, and the doctors advised him to take it easy. He was in the real estate business, and he was had been a farmer, of course. And he had this farm, so he moved back to the original beginning where his father had a store. His father and grandfather died in the meantime, 1925, and that was about 27 or 28. He went back and opened up the store on Flat Hollow, which was a small country store.
And that was the original John Harton.
That was originally John J.B. Harton and Son. It was known. That was what was on the, as I have photographs, is up on the, you know, they built stores them days, up on the, they had a sign across the top, a big flat place. Looked like Western type store. And Depression still started setting then, and of course Dad had several pieces of property and several pieces of houses to rent, and a lot of people had gotten debt to us in Fullerton, not too bad, but Depression began to slow, the businesses started slowing down all over the country, and I think he foreseen some problems developing, so he went over to this store on Flat Hall and opened it up, and he let me run that as a boy about 16-year-old boy, and I don't think I had too good a business head on me, but still we didn't lose any money. But as the Depression got worse, he saw that these were good people, they're good friends, they was carrying his merchandise off, they couldn't pay for it, and he realized that he was going to be in real serious trouble. He had a lot, but he owed $700 to a wholesale house that he had on credit, and he had spent this food out to people, and they couldn't pay him, so he closed his store down. And they had threatened to take everything he had, and he had several houses and property, and it was really rough. A lot of people don't realize that what will happen to you when depression hits, but seemed like it. Now, he never did get over it. He was always lived in fear, and he taught us to be careful and cautious. The fact is, maybe that's one reason that I've been overcautious, because we saw we almost lost everything we had, over $700, and that's just the price of a junk car nowadays. Anyway, my mother aired some land, property, from her father, and she saw he was had some troubles, worried about it. Just he thought it was, he just couldn't figure it out why that he couldn't raise $700. I'd give him something up. So she sold her holdings, and they almost paid off this little old $700, and it was a big thing them days. And we closed the store down, went back to the farm, and he had already been a farmer to my place of first memory back on the hill, and we started raising tomatoes, and we really worked for a living. I was the oldest, and my younger brother. So from then on, we really worked, but we knew there was hard times all around us, but we never did go hungry. We had enough to live on, and we banked money nearly every year. And he peddled, he had 29 model Ford, and we raised tomatoes. And in them days, you could take Kentuckians could go up north and cut corn and come back home, get a barrel of flour, and half a barrel of, 8 sacks would be a barrel of flour, and 4 sacks of cornmeal, 2 or 3 slabs of bacon, a can of lard, and with what they can, then they could survive the winter. That's what a lot of them would do in this area.
You spoke of going up north and cutting corn. What did this, did a lot of people do there?
Oh, there was, those days they didn't have these big machines, corn pickers. You go up north and you go to these farmers and you'd cut corn and shock it, and then people would shuck corn, and that's where they harvest their corn. And that wasn't too far away. We were only talking about 100 miles north, around Columbus, Ohio, Washington, C.H., or north of Chillicothe. A lot of Kentuckians would go up there and make their winter supply, and then they would come back and sort of hibernate through the winter and hunt, and they'd kill game to eat. And of course, everybody those days raised their own hogs. And they'd butcher, I know Dad would butcher some hogs. We didn't have deep freezes, and we'd butcher a brute, an animal, fatten it. And Mom would can this meat and can it on a stove, and we'd have beef, and just like canned beef all winter. And we'd have our meat salted down and with her canned stuff. And truthfully, we really didn't know really what real hard times was, because Dad had always been a conservative person and took care of pretty well what he made. But it wasn't, what hurt him was what he tried to help others that couldn't pay him. But he would put me out on a bicycle collecting on paydays. And see, he knew when the paydays were. It'd be the meal payday every 2 weeks and NW pay. And I would go around to these people that owed him. And I had a big pocket in my overalls, and I'd have my account book on one side. And I would go to these people's house, and they'd pay $2 a place round. And I'd come back home sometimes as high as $20. Some days have a good day that people would probably rake up some money, and maybe high as $75. And of course, eventually we collected, I would say, at least 75% of this money in. Of course, so you see, these people were getting a lot of up in age, and they would die, and we would just mark them paid. We didn't go after the family or the state. And now that we're getting up now in... You shut it off. Well, like I said, eventually we come out on top, and we were doing pretty good. But now I'd like to go back in my first beginning when he started this store, and what I knew about Fullerton, Kentucky. Just at that time, there was a semi-pro ball, I guess, played there. They was local. Sunday was a big day. There was always a baseball game going on. That's what they call Coney Island. As I understand that maybe Coney Island, Cincinnati, possibly I was told was named after Coney Island, New York, which was a big amusement park. And then Fullerton, started with the Davis family, named Coney Island in Fullerton. At one time, I understand, there was a continuous run amusement park there, but it had just shut down about when we moved to Fullerton. And it was a, at that time, though, it was a bustling town. One of the, well, it grew up. You see, the nucleus was Portsmouth High, and people would, there was two ferries at that time. There was one at Fullerton, and then there's one at South Portsmouth, operated by the CNO. And all these people more or less communicated across the river for these jobs, but there wasn't too many jobs in Fullerton area. One Taylor Brickyard was one of the, well, they boasted about, employed, I don't know how many people at that time. I think at the present day there's around 300 people works there. But as I remember the cattle drives in Fullerton, this is things that I'm just popping up in my memory as I talk here. They would bring these, say, maybe 50 head of cattle out of shoals, and they would drive these cattle to the slaughterhouse, and they had cattle dogs who would herd these animals through Fullerton, and they would, I never, don't remember how, but I think they put them on the boat, they didn't put any cars on, and then they herded them up, they drove up through town to the slaughterhouse, or across town over to Schistler's, I believe was the name of the slaughterhouse, and that was out about 8 or 9 blocks north of the river, next to the Saudi River in Portsmouth High. And I had heard that at one time, I never saw this, that they drove turkeys to town that way, but I never saw this. I just heard talk of it. But
well, how did they get them across the river?
I don't know that. I don't know whether they cooked them up or not, or how, but I did hear that that's one time they did do that. I don't know. It was just
I mean the cattle. Did they?
They would put them on the, drive them on the boat, and I understand it. I didn't see them put them on the boat, but I did see the cattle come down. Fact is, one of the dogs stopped off in the, let me see, that was in their early, late 20s, and he stopped off. They had a dog that was what they call in heat, and he stopped off there, and the cattle went on, and this dog was left in Fullerton, and finally a fellow said that this dog's around here, and he sold him to him for a quarter, and he was a cattle dog, a very intelligent dog. He was a dog of a kind of a stubby-nosed shepherd dog with a tail that was half as long as the average dog, because I know it hadn't been bobbed because it was pointed. And the fellow told me, he said, now that's a stalk of a cattle dog. And I kept that dog. We had that dog around home until he was probably of a dog's age. He was probably about 75 years old, counting about 6 or 7 years old for a dog. But he was, anyway, he was a very intelligent dog. And that's one thing that I could remember, the cattle drives, because he was what was left in my memory of the cattle drives in the middle 20s or something near that, or the late 20s. But anyway, I know they could tell some tales about the Model T Fords about that time. My grandfather and grandmother, I never will forget her. She was a very articulate lady. She had a nice, I don't think it was fur coat, and she's a very dainty person. She's always wanted to be real nice, and she had a lap robe, and granddad had a rubber-tired buggy, and a fine horse. I never will forget her. She was Topsy. She was a buggy horse. I believe that Topsy was a pacer. And I remember I rode in this buggy. And at that time, though, my dad was operating this store, and Grandma and Grandpa would bring butter and eggs. They had a small farm on Flat Hollow, and bring butter and eggs over to the store. And Granddad would pick me up on the way to school from to and from, and I'd get in that buggy, and they would bring you stuff into Fullerton. But I remember one time, Topsy was a pretty well used to cars, but a fellow named Willie Boyles that had bought a Model T Ford, and it was a downed, and you know, Fords, when they wasn't running right, they would backfire. They shoot like a cannon. Well, Grandma and Grandpa had started down to their daughter's house in Tiger Bend at what they call Flat Hollow School, where I first started attending school in 1921, and he started to cross the creek there, and old Topsy was hooked up to this rubber tired buggy, as I understand it, and Grandma was, they were going to visit, and this Model T Ford backfired, and Topsy made a 90 degree turn and run away and threw Grandma out in the schoolyard, and Grandpa, and the Grandpa, when he got straightened up, and Grandma wasn't hurt very bad, just shook up, scared to death. He said that there ought to be a law outlawing these I forget what he said, confirmed whole automobiles. He said, not safe to be on a highway with them around. He really believed that. He thought they was a ruination of the country, automobiles. Well, there's a lot of people right this day that don't care too much about them, especially the Amish, where I cut corn up north, I told about earlier. We met a lot of Amish people up there, and they were all out in their buggies on Sunday, because I remember one morning they were all out in their buggies going to church. But I'm skipping around quite a bit. But anyway, was my memories of Fullerton, Kentucky. Well, I knew then in the late 20s, a fellow named Jim Hannes went up in where we played in Fullerton. It's called Frog Pond. And it was a vast area of farms, I don't know who all owned it, and he laid out a street, what is now Main Street, and he started the ferry up there, because in the meantime, in the 27, there was a bridge built, the U.S. Grant Bridge was built and opened, I believe, September the 22nd, 1927, was started in 1924. Well, they saw that Fullerton had reached its heyday, so they laid off what is now South Shore. And he started to build a little better homes. They had a little more room up there than Fullerton had. So everybody was kidding about it. Everybody was keeping up the Joneses, and the people were fairly prosperous. They moved up into South Shore and bought lots and built new homes. And we moved away, behind my story. We moved away, though, like I said, about the time this depression hit. When this depression hit, it seemed like it slowed down South Shore. Then up in what they call, right above South Shore, they opened up a place called A.T. Pack, I believe, was a developer. He was sort of competitive with James Hannes, and he opened up him a street up there called, and they run into some Indians up there called Indiola Avenue. Later in years,
this was an Indian graveyard.
This was an Indian graveyard, and I never will forget my dad took us up there in a 1927 model Ford, I believe it was, and he had bought from Sam Reeder, which was a Ford dealer. In those days, the story was Henry Ford said you could have any car color you wanted as long as it was black. That was just an old saying, you know, that sort of a little gimmick that they'd put out. And anyway, he drove me up there as a kid, and there was a 7-foot Indian there, and a scientist or a archaeologist, I don't know what his position was, in UK, University of Kentucky. He came up there, and I stood up on this grave, and he was down in with a little trowel, I never will forget it, looking at this big long Indian. And they said they had been there 500 years, these Indians. Well, there were numerous Indians buried, and when they opened up this road, it's a 50-foot street, and he was competing with Hannah's, and he wanted him a 50-foot street. So Main Street in South Shore, I believe, is 50
foot. You mean it's 50-foot wide?
It's 50-foot wide. And they laid houses off along the side. Oh, like I said, depression hit about that time. And at later years, I acquired one of those houses, my wife and I, and we moved up on this street. And even at that day, when they started the building again, the post-war II boom started, they would start digging these Indians out. I never will forget the time that one fellow over there dug a house, a basement out, and I don't know, it bothered me, and I gathered up all those bones, and I brought them over on the lots that we had, three lots, and I dug a grave, and silently I buried those Indians, because I didn't think it was right to have those Indian bones discarded as trash. And that was just one of my inner feelings that now, I don't know where I'm at now, I'm just skipping around here. But anyway, I've pretty well brought you up what I thought about Fullerton and the things I remember about early Fullerton. I never will forget some of the things that the boys, I thought they were mean boys. Being a little country boy, I began to learn fast how to defend myself, because they were mean and they liked to fight. And of course, they'd been a survival of the fittest. They weren't gangs at that time, but believe me, those boys had tangled with other boys, and very quickly I found out that if you could, they could push you around, but you'd have to be miserable. And so I found out one thing that I had learned, that when I'd get into a scuffle with one, I'd declare total war on him. I'd bite him, I'd kick him, I'd do anything I could think of. And about one time was all they wanted to fool with me, because I never hurt anyone really, but they just wanted, I just become one of the, and so I was accepted very shortly as one of the boys, and growing up in Fullerton. Of course, after the like I said, that we moved back over to Flat Hall, and I lost more or less contact with the Fullerton people, but I had to, by the depression causing that, this to happen. Never talked about the doctors in the South Shore and Fullerton area, but at that, when I was growing up, there were two doctors. One of them was Dr. Meadows, and he was he was delivered probably more babies than anyone in this country. He delivered me and all of my sister and my two other brothers younger than me. And then now Doc Mars, it seems like Doc Meadows, is that was the one that they called him the granny doctor, and he was probably the one they would call if a midwife, now there were a lot of midwives working in this area that delivered babies, and some of them had delivered as high as 10, 12, but the people that could afford it would always call Doc Meadows. I think the cost was around $15 or $20, it wasn't very much. But Dr. Mars was more of a medical doctor, and like I was talking about, after World War I, he had a son named Thurston. I believe Thurston was by his first wife, and I know his second wife was a Womack, and she was up from around Greenham. She was a very dignified lady, and she was a quite conservative type person, and I don't think she mixed too much with people in Fullerton, but she was a well-respected lady, being out of a very, considered a good family around Greenham. Anyway, this son, Thurston, was a gunner, an airplane, on World War I. And I heard him reminisce and tell about his machine gun would shoot through the propeller of his plane, a German plane. Anyway, I think he was had some World War I injuries. And he showed aptitude for being a better doctor, so Doc Mars, his father, sent him, and he married Mildred Burroughs. I believe she was a Lewis County school teacher. And they were a very promising young couple, and he sent him to Vienna, I don't know if that's pronounced that way, Vienna, mm-hmm. Austria, mm-hmm. to become a nose and throat specialist. And he was over there and studied medicine for some time, maybe 2 years, year or 2 years, I don't know exactly, but he came back and he opened up a practice at Portsmouth High. And he was considered one of the being in this valley that people have sinus trouble. He became one of the most famous and notable physicians to help people that had sinus problems. And I never will forget his father. There was one fellow, I won't mention his name. A fellow walked up to him and told him, said, "I'm going to shoot you," and he shot him in the car. And he run down to the Doc Meadows' office and said, "Doc, I've been shot." And the doc said, "Hold everything. Now, don't get excited. You're not dead yet." And so he took him in and took his shirt off and said, "Where'd the bullet hit you?" And he showed him, it hit a rib. And the bullet, they said, went around, followed the rib around, and he found a knot on his back. And the doc said, "Hold everything here now." And he got his little knife out, I don't know what you call it, they got names, terminology for these little knives, and he got a hold of this thing and he popped it and it come out just like open up a boil, and he said the bullet fell on the floor. And prohibition was in then, and you could write a prescription to a drugstore, so he got him some Old Taylor, and this fellow drank some of that Old Taylor. He put a little arnica on it, they called it, probably iodine. The doctor, the place where the bullet went in, the doctor, the place where it come out, said, "Oh, you'll be all right in a few days." Said, "You're lucky." But that was one of the things that I remember about the doctors. believe we were talking about the doctors. But as this Dr. Meadows, he practiced till, I believe he was must have been up in his 80s or close to it. And of course, there was a young druggist that came into Fullerton in the latter 20s, the name of Herman McDonald. He was in the Army too, I believe, World War I, and he studied to be a pharmacist. And he came into Fullerton and opened up a drugstore, and that was, as far as I know, that was the second drugstore that was ever in Fullerton. As I said before, the Meadows family, and it was right adjacent to Doc Marsh's office. And in them days, if you were sick, a doctor could write you a prescription for a pint of whiskey. And there was a little story went around that some fellas that never drank any that
this
said,
was during prohibition. Right?
This was during prohibition. There was a little story going around that they'd found that they'd drank a lot of whiskey that they'd never tasted. The doc had a man was sick, he'd just write a prescription, and they'd go over here to this drugstore with prescription. It was all legal that way, and they'd get, old Taylor was supposed to have been the top grade whiskey. Of course, the moonshiners, they were really plentiful, and I never will forget that my dad, he never had any trouble with the moonshiners, but he used to kid a lot when he was in the store business, and he'd say that his sugar would make a gallon more than anybody else's sugar, and if it didn't, bring it back, and he'd make it good, but he never had any whiskey brought back, because he was dry. He talked dry and voted dry, but he didn't butt in anybody's business. He never would turn a, if he knew a guy was a making a moonshiner, that's one thing Dad wouldn't do. He wouldn't interfere because they'd burn your barn down. They'd burn your house down. And that's one thing he never got into a moonshiner's war, because he never, about as near he come to any moonshining was selling sugar to the moonshiners that made whiskey. That was the extent of his knowledge of it, but he pretty well knew who was buying all that sugar, and he knew good and well they wasn't canning that many peaches and apples. But he had one rule of thumb, that he'd leave them alone, and he never bothered them. He didn't give them no problems. He would not turn them into the law, and he lived with them, and they were his best friends. He would trade horses with them and trade mules with them. They bought groceries at his store. But he just knew enough about Kentuckians to just leave him alone. And don't meddle. Don't butt in. He'd say, that's their business. And there was one story I never will forget that told about a Kentuckian and the moonshine business. And this fellow had educated 7 children and sent them through college. Well, the income tax people was a little bit inquisitive. How a man, an old farmer, could send 7 kids and give them a college education. And they asked him one day, they come up and they're checking all around, they asked him, said, you spend a lot of money on these kids. Said, what? We can't figure out how you're making. Said, where do you make all your money? And he said, I'm self-employed. And that was the limit. They couldn't go any farther. And of course, nowadays, they'd hound you to death. But they couldn't figure him out, but that's as far as he'd tell them. And of course, he could take the Fifth Amendment, and that was all they could do with him. But they just dropped that case. Anyway, I know that in our community here, I don't know whether you would call it a moonshiner's war or not, but they was competitive in this business, the way I understand it. One fellow have a certain business, and if another fellow would start making, he'd be enterprising enough, and if he wasn't awful careful, he'd be turned into revenueers, because he'd be infringing on the other fellow's business and sales. And I never will forget that we had some preachers in the area who would you had to watch them. Now they would they'd turn you in, and they were, because they felt like they was doing the duty of the Lord to prosecute you and enforce the law, and they were self-appointed prosecutors almost. But I know the boys knew who they were, and they had to be awful careful. I never will forget one fellow that was supposed to be taking a big load, the Model T Ford, on the boat to Portsmouth, and he got word that they was going to raid him. They called them the dry dicks, or the revenueers was going to be on the boat. So he stopped down the road, and there was an old lady had a churn full of buttermilk. This is a true story. This is not just a make-up story. And he hid all of his whiskey. He had it in the fruit jars. You've heard of fruit jars, Rankers. That's the kind of a jars that was most of they could get a hold of, you see, was fruit jars. So they put a rubber on it, and that's where the name of fruit jar drinkers come in. That's where they sold their whiskey. So he hid all this whiskey in a fodder shock and loaded up a load of buttermilk in this Model T Ford. It was probably a 22 or 23 model. He was quite a mechanic, I guess, and he went all out on the boat just as usual, and boy, I guess they all ganged around this old man. I won't mention his name, but anyway, they said, "Well, come on, we got you." And they said, "What for?" I said, "We know you've got a load of whiskey here." They said, "Well, I ain't got no whiskey. I got buttermilk." They said, "We got to see it." So they started pulling these jars of buttermilk out, and they knew they'd been had, but they never did figure out how he got tip off. Because they knew he started with whiskey. They thought they did, but he never got there with it. They had some embarrassing, some moments of themselves, these revenuers. But it was a common thing in days for these revenuers, and people would catch a fellow with a pint of whiskey, and they'd jerk you up before the grand jury and try to make you tell where they got this whiskey at. But these boys were pretty close mouthed because they knew if they told where they got, as soon as they got out of jail, they wouldn't be able to buy any more whiskey there. And then probably the man they bought off would go to jail, and they would create kind of problems. But that was one of the reasons that prohibition failed, that they just couldn't enforce the law. So I heard one story about a fellow that went back here on on one of the White Oaks and was making, and he was in with the law some way or another. I don't know how they paid off, but he looked out one day and he saw the deputy sheriff riding as fast as he could, and he said, "You better clear up everything out because the revenue was on the way." And by the time he got ahead of them and he'd notified all the moonshiners that to clear up, they cleaned up everybody and everything got in the clear, and that was one reason that prohibition failed, because they claim it's one of the oldest evils of men, and you just can't control it because you just can't tell people what to do. And that was one of the reasons I think that the prohibition failed in this whole area.
People sort of helped one another if they...
I believe they did. It was an easy way of making a living. It might not have been the best way, according to the preachers, but it was an income. And at one time here in this whole country, you'd be surprised from what I've been told how many... prominent families, influential families, and how there was fortunes, and they were people that would want to buy a home, and they would jump in that never made whiskey, and secretly or silently make enough whiskey to pay for their home, and clear or quit and didn't drink or associate them but did drink. Now these things happened because it was a lucrative thing, and everybody wanted to make money, and that's the same as it is today.
Was this during prohibition?
This was during prohibition. And the trouble was the whiskey, though, as a boy, it was dangerous to drink it. They made it, and a lot of it was made, it wasn't clean, it wasn't safe, it was hurry-up made, and they made it out of anything, and it was destructive. It would kill you something, it would poison you. But I never will forget when Roosevelt was elected now, and he promised, I'll leave you beer by Christmas, or whiskey's elected in November, December, and then the first whiskeys I remember buying, you could buy Thomas Jefferson 100 proof whiskey for 65 cents a pint. And I mean to tell you, it'd make you drunk, but it wouldn't poison you. And when that come in, why, it more or less, at that price, of course, they started putting this sin tax on it, the government did, and they've got the same amount, the same whiskey you could have bought back in the 32 or 33 for 65 cents, I think it's about $3 now, or three and a half. But that just shows you how things change over the years. And I don't know why I'm talking about whiskey, but it's just part of the American scene of life in this back hill country. And we're not looking too far back either.
Well, do you think that these people needed this still running this moonshine to help them make a living during the Depression?
I think that even before the Depression, they were using it to make a living. I never will forget that back on top of the hill there, they found a dead man. And they were supposed to have been a moonshiner. They call it Dead Man Ridge. They were supposed to have been a moonshiner back there. And now this was in the 20s, and they don't know whether this guy was in a poker game or what the trouble was, but they found him. He decomposed somewhat, but he had $300 on him and a 38 pistol. And it was quite a news story. It was something about the days of Floyd Collins and, you know, the newspaper people. Well, they were just looking for a big news story, so there was a fellow back there, I don't know what he was doing, fox hunting or something. They found this fellow. And I later talked to an old man that I like to talk to, like in nostalgia and back history. And I said, I heard that they find this guy, this dead man that had a bullet in his head, the county officials, $300 for disturbing the peace. And I never will forget the old man Vanover, McKinley Vanover. And he was quite a character, and he was a very interesting person to talk to. And I would just give anything if this tape could have talked to him a while. He said, no, buddy, you're wrong. I said, well, what did they find him? He said, for carrying a concealed weapon. I said, they could find him $300, this dead man. And I said, is that true? And he said, that's a true story. And I may be, probably that's the extent of a lot of the things I knew about whiskey. We've talked long enough about that. Back in Fullerton, as I remember those days, it was a country store. What they call now is a Paul and Morris mall store. They say now if we had to depend on those stores and didn't have supermarkets and a checkout system, we'd starve to death because they just couldn't write it all. They'd write it all down. And mostly those days, you would charge the groceries and pay cash for your clothes. But as I understand nowadays, most people pay cash for their clothes. They pay cash for the groceries and charge their clothes. Now, that's the way things have changed. But every store... you go in the store, they'd do everything they could to accommodate you. They were competitive, and it kept them on the ball. That old free American, free enterprise, see? And they were the accommodatingest people on earth. You'd come to the store, and you delivered. And I remember my grandfather, the first deliveries, he had a pair of horses. And he would deliver with a sled. My granddad had even known to deliver with his wheel bar. That went on all over the country.
Why did he use a sled? But the roads sled?
Well, these roads were not passable by a car. And so he had a fellow by the name of Ernest Dunaway that was a delivery boy. And he probably told me more about my grandfather than anyone, because he would load up old Dick and his sled, and he'd make these deliveries. And I'm going back. I was back a little bit in my story. And I never will forget the time that he was making the delivery back on top of the hill. And
which hill was
this? Back on the, what they call Pond Ridge. There's a family lived out there, and he was taking a load of feed out there and groceries and things. And there was a heavy storm come up. Now, Ernie had old Dick and a sled. That was about all they had was sled roads them days. And this tornado or storm come up, and that was probably the first tornado that ever I even heard mentioned in this area. And of course, like I said, at that time I was going to school to my dad, and that was along about 1921 in March, and I never saw such a wind blow, and that schoolhouse was shaking. And dad, someone come down the road running in a hurry and said that a tornado had went through South Portsmouth. And it had picked up a schoolhouse. It was a flat top schoolhouse, and took the top off of it. And I believe there were some kids, must have been around lunchtime, in the yard, and it dropped this school roof. And it was a large, pretty large building. It was probably maybe 60 or 75 foot wide by 100 foot long, and it dropped this building on all these kids, and they killed one boy and broke another leg. A chimney fell on a boy named, I believe his name was Dennis Boggs. Well, Dad heard about this, and he turned the screw out right quick. Of course, the heavy winds were still blowing, and I never will forget, as we was walking up the road going home, we couldn't hardly stand up. Us kids couldn't.
Well, what happened to Ernie?
So this wind come around that ridge so fast, it blew that sled out of the road, and old Dick, this big old perching horse, helped to this, that's kept the sled blowing. It flopped the sled clear off the road. This wind was so strong back on this ridge, but where this wind that blew this schoolhouse up was probably all 3/4 mile north of where Ernie was at, this storm pattern. And as we was talking about stores, but anyway, that's one incident I never will forget that I brought in there about the deliveries.
This was back in the country, right?
This was back in the country, even around Fullerton. Yeah, this was a country store I was just talking about.
Did they use wagons in Fullerton? Or?
Well, at that time, at the first part of Fullerton, as I said, we moved in there about the time that the wagons were disappearing and the automobiles and old trucks was coming in. Now, I can tell you a few things about the barber shops. We had 2 barber shops, and that was before, that's where men would gather around. Of course, you know what barber shop harmony was, and they wasn't too much of that. And they would be a fellas come through with dulcimers, and they would probably sell them, and they'd play them, and then banjo pickers, and things like that. And I never will forget one time that there was a fellow had, it was a fellow had a barber shop, and his home was adjacent to it, but in the middle of it, it was 4-foot space. And this was a little funny incident. And there was a fellow got drunk, and this old man, and he passed out. And they was this was the only fellow had running water. He had a reservoir up on the hill there, and about halfway up Fullerton, and he had running water, and the water wasn't too cold. And they put this hose on this old man, and it had been a dry spell, and it hadn't rained none for about 5 or 6 weeks, and it was real dry in August. And this old preacher came down the road, and I will forget, old man Klein. And he stopped at my dad's store, and he was so cracked up laughing, he couldn't hardly talk. And he said, I met a fellow up there in the road a while ago that was wet. He was the water running off his clothes. And I said, well, brother, what in the world happened to you? He said, he was as sober as a judge. He said, they had the damnedest rain down in Fullerton that ever I saw fall. And he said, they just drowned me. And that old man looked all around the preacher, and he said, why, he just couldn't figure it out. He said, there wasn't a drop of water in the dirt or anything. So he came on down to my dad's store, and he was telling him about this. Well, they had finally figured it out what had happened. These ornery boys had soaked this old man down and wet him real good. And that was one of the funny things. Well, this old preacher was a humorous old man, and he was quite a storyteller himself. And he told a tale about, I never will forget it, as a lad listened to him. He said that there was a fella come through a hobo, and he asked his lady, he said, could you give me something to eat? She said, well, I'll tell you what. I'm a widow woman, but said, anytime anybody comes through here, said, there's a big pile of wood that the boys drove in, and he said, there's a cross-cut saw out there, one man saw, and said, if you'll saw me up some wood, said, I'll get you some dinner. And of course, those days, they trusted everybody. And so she went ahead and fixed the dinner, and then, so said she, this might be an old tale, but anyway, this preacher told us. She went out and hollered this fellow, said, well, I got your dinner ready, and there wasn't nobody out there. I said, she went out there, and on the axe, he's stuck in the blocks, he had a little note wrote, and this axe sticking in it said, you saw me, but you never saw me saw. And this fellow could tell those tales, and they would tell another tale there, not this preacher, but this fellow run this barber shop, and he liked his little nip. He'd cut hair, and he always kept some pretty good moonshine around. But he also kept a bottle of vinegar, and the same kind of a bottle. Of course, you know vinegar, and this was charred whiskey. It looked exactly alike, but he knew which side the vinegar was on. And this preacher could smell his breath. I mean, he had a real sweet breath. Man, that he could smell that alcohol on it, and corn whiskey, and corn squeezings, and he said, this barber said, give me a drink of that whiskey. And this barber said, well, I don't care. he said, all right. And he reached down and got a hold of this vinegar and said, take a big one now, because there comes somebody. And this preacher put that vinegar up to his mouth, took a big shot of it, strangling, and he jumped clear out of the chair. Said, what in the hell was that? That's one of the interesting tales. They told this one was the truth. Across the river, I could tell another one that they told about. I don't want to tell preacher tales, but anyway, these boys were colored boys, and this fellow was a good friend of mine. I worked with him. See, later years, I went to work this steel mill, and he said that they would they was drinking, had a fifth of whiskey, and the minister come along, called a minister. He said, the minister come along, and he said, what are you guys drinking? He said, whiskey. He said, well, give me a drink of that. And said, he run behind, they said, in the alley there, behind a board, signboard, and he took a big drink of it. And they said, this preacher said, what are you doing that for? He said, I'm afraid somebody sees me. And he said, he stood around there for a little bit and spit a little cotton and talked and said, Dick, he said, let me have that again. So he went behind that board and took another drink of that. And he said, what's the matter, you preacher? He said, I don't want to seize me. He said, my congregation could be a passenger. And after a while, he said, come back out there and stomped around, talked a while, and he was all cutting up and carrying on drinks. He said, give me that fifth whiskey. He said, just up and drank it right in the middle of the street. And he said, preacher? He said, what's the matter? He said, I don't care who sees me now. And these are some of the tales that the and I'm not throwing up. They were all ministers weren't that way, but they just like to tell, you know, tales on preachers. I don't know why. They're the blunt of a lot of problems. But there was a little thing I remembered, and Snuffy Smith, the Sheriff Tate, reminded me of some things that went on in my earlier days. The parson said to Sheriff Tate, he said that, why in the world don't people do what they ought to do? And Sheriff Tate reminded him, said, now if they did, said that we'd both be out of work. So that was what kept us all going in the earlier days, in my memory of the prohibition and the days of that age. I've covered a lot of the past. I could talk for a week probably and tell them things that happened around, but I'll start on my life, it was affected by the Depression and everything. In 1937, under the Roosevelt era, the things started moving, and a friend of my dad was sort of I don't know, you wouldn't call him a loan shark, but he would loan people money and befriend people, and this one fellow was a horse trader that worked at the mill and a cattle buyer. Now, I didn't find this out till 20 years later, and he would go to my dad, and he'd say, I need $300, Perry, and there's going to be a big stock sale down here, and I can make myself about $100, I'll make you about $25. Well, my dad would always carry the, not bragging about it or anything, but it seemed like a lot of those fellows those days, they'd carry around maybe anywhere from $200 to $300 to $800 to $900, and it seemed as though they didn't want to carry up to over $1,000. That was they'd be afraid, so they'd get scared they got over $1,000. They'd carry that kind of amount of money around in their pocket. Well, Dad would loan this dealer $300, and he had a whole gang of kids, and he would go to these sales, and he would just start bidding wild, and he'd buy a whole bunch of cash. You could buy a bunch of cash $300, and no one couldn't figure out where this fellow was getting his money, and my dad wouldn't tell, and then he would pay my dad back. He was honest. He'd pay my dad back, and maybe I don't know what interest he'd give him, maybe give him $25 for loaning $300. Well, he'd have maybe a 75 clear. And so, well, then this fellow wanted to befriend my dad, and he said, well, does Orville want a job? And he said, yeah, I reckon. He said, well, I'll get him a job over at the mill. So somehow or another, I got a call from the mill of this. Now, remember, I didn't know anything about it. All this was going on. He wanted to befriend my dad, and I got a job at the mill.
What mill was
it? That was Wheeling Steel in 1937, and early in the spring. And so at the meantime, though, before that, I got a job, worked at the mill. I had worked at the Vulcan last, and it was a little wood heel factory, and they didn't pay too much money, and I think I went to work for 28 cents an hour. And I looked around, and I don't know, I was a young boy, and I saw the model cars they were driving, and I was around some of their homes, and I decided that there wasn't much there for me. They'd been there all their lives, and they had accomplished any more than that, and the steel mill had a name of making the best money. So I went to work the steel mill for $4.80 a day. And I continued that, and that was in 1937. And I, of course, I was laid off some, but I hung right in there every time they called me back. And I retired from this steel mill 40 years later in 1977 on the 31st of January. So I almost had in 40 years, but it was one of the best jobs. And I had started out as a laborer, and finally I bid a job in. You had to help so long, and you had to step up the ladder, and they put you out with these old boys were real pipe fitters. And they would run you from here to there. You would bid on this job and that job, and they'd give you a wide scope of the mill. But whenever they got through with you, when you went through that mill, you was qualified to fit pipe any place. You were knowledgeable. You knew how to take care of yourself. And
this was your...
this was my trade, and I
they had other trades too, didn't they?
I worked as a rigger during World War II, and shortly after that I bid a job in as an apprentice. I was making good wages, but I stepped down and served my time as apprentice pipe fitter, steam fitter, and I become a certified steam fitter, pipe fitter. And you can figure out that when I began there, I was making 60 cents an hour, but for 8 hour day was $4.80. And when I retired there, about 40 years later, I was making almost $8 an hour. I got to make this one comment to talk about the olden days. A lot of people would say they'd like to go back to the olden days. Now, the olden days, to most people, you had an outhouse, you had a well with a rope on it, you had to draw your water, you had a potbelly stove or a coal stove, you heated your house. We didn't have central heating. A lot of people didn't have electricity. I think the quality of life has improved. I don't know how long it'll last, but what is the biggest worry, will the national debt and borrowing hold out to keep this quality of life that we're used to forever? Now, that is a question in a lot of people's mind on these wages. Now, the problem is now that people retire now, if the inflation keeps on, their quality of life will be destroyed eventually, because their wages or retirements will not be as worth as much as it was when they elected to retire.
Thank you, Mr. Harrington.